Okay, so here we are. This is the second lecture in chapter six. Chapter six is on government. A couple things before we get into the PowerPoint slides. One thing, I've got an article here from the Wall Street. It says it's on the Review and Outlook, which is the opinion page, my favorite page. And it says Japan's devaluation warning for Europe. And it says here, businesses face the same disincentives to invest as ever. Overregulation, high taxes, protectionism, and lack of competition. Something that's just really crystallized in my mind, what we're going to learn in the next chapter is that there were certain events that happened during the 1920s that led to the Depression of the 30s. But those events alone didn't cause the severity of the Depression.
It was how the government responded.
Yeah, it was how government responded to those events. Now, there is a major event today that, I believe is going to be cause a similar situation. And that event is quantitative easing. Now, what is quantitative easing?
It's when the U.S. Treasury it's when the Federal Reserve creates money to buy bonds from the Department of the Treasury.
Right. And then the Treasury, of course, spends that money.
But spends the economy.
And so we get new money. Now, what is one of the purposes, perhaps the main purpose of quantitative easing?
Its other name, monetizing the debt.
Yeah, but what's the purpose of quantitative? I mean, why has the government created so much money? I mean, let me take that back. Why has the Federal Reserve created so much money, and why has there been, we've talked about ZIRP before.
Zero interest rate policy.
Yeah, zero interest rate policy, and that's been our policy pretty much since the collapse of 2007-2008. So, the purpose of quantitative easing, at least one of the purposes, is to keep interest rates as low as possible. And the thinking is that if interest rates are low, then that will stimulate demand. But what appears to be happening is that those low interest rates are forcing investors, particularly of like pension fund managers, to take very high risks, because what they're doing is that they're chasing yield instead of safety. Now, take a retirement fund, for example. By the rules of the game, they have to make a certain return, and they have a lot of outgo. You know, people retire, and therefore, you know, they receive regular payments, and so that's especially with the baby boomers retiring now. That's a huge outgo for these retirement funds. So because their backs are against the wall, what are these retirement funds doing to juice up their returns?
Investing in risky.
Yes, exactly. They're investing in risky instruments.
Is that moral hazard?
No, something different. And I was watching the news program yesterday, and they were talking about this very same thing, of how so many, both individuals and institutions, are taking huge risks because they're chasing yield, it's called, because they can't get a return in terms of interest, so they're trying to get their returns by these risky investments. Now, what is wrong with risky investments? Well, what's wrong with risky investments is that once the economy starts to go south, and the economy will go south, I mean, that's just the normal trend of things. You know, things get better, things get worse, things get better, things get worse. It's called the business cycle. And when things start to go south, then when you have all this debt, and they're in risk, especially the debt that's in risky, you have a lot of debt, number one. And number two, you have a lot of debt that's in risky places. And once the economy starts to go south, this debt and these risky investments tend to feed upon themselves. you know, person A loses out and then can't pay person B, and person B can't pay person C, and C can't pay D, and it's like a dominoes effect. And I predict that this is really going to cause serious economic problems. See, now what caused this? Well, what caused it is really government policy. The government policy of zero interest rates is going to cause a tremendous upheaval, not only in the United States, but in the whole world. And that's something that this article here talks about, too, about, you know, it's not just the United States, but it's Japan and all of Europe, and it's really, you know, most of the world that's in the same situation. Anyway, we'll talk about more on this later, you know, in the semester.
Starting on slide 9, and what is a merit good? I did talk about this last time. A merit good satisfies a want or a need like public education, safe food, helmets, and reliable brakes. So government, one role of government is to try to encourage merit goods. And how does government promote merit goods? By subsidies and regulations. Now, here's where we get down to some nitty-gritty here. What are examples of first- and third-party laws? Well, when you're talking about merit goods, there are first-party and third-party laws. Wearing helmets is a third-party law.
Okay, it says first, but you said third. Sounds like you said
it's first, and wearing helmets is a first-party law, and good brakes is a third-party law. So let me explain the difference between first and third. First is, for example, if you wear a helmet riding a motorcycle, does that help anyone else but you? No, it doesn't, right? I mean, it protects you, but doesn't protect anyone else. But if the government says that you have to have your car inspected once a year to make sure you've got good brakes, then that helps you, but it also helps other people, right? And so the difference between these two is if the law only helps you, that's a first-party law. If the law helps other people, that's a third-party law. Now, there's lots of agreement on third-party laws that it's good for government to make sure that we have laws that help us protect one from the other, that, you know, that people, when they drive cars, they've got good brakes and things like that. But there's some disagreement on what role should government have when it comes to first-party laws. Because when it comes to first-party laws, what you've really got is a parent-child relationship. You know, when you've got children, you lay down certain rules for those children so they don't hurt themselves. Well, with first-party laws, that's what we've got. We've got government making laws that would, you know, only benefit that single person. And so it's like a parent making rules to protect their children. So anyway, there are some people, you know, that don't think that the government ought to be involved in first-party laws, although there's lots of agreement that the government should be involved in third-party laws. So what is a social cost? Cost of production which businesses bear no responsibility. Now, one of the failings of a free market system... did I forget to do... No, I'm okay. One of the failings of a free market system is that we have undesirable byproducts of the industrial process. They're called social costs. See, businesses have a incentive to pass on as many costs as possible onto society. And we call those costs social costs because society has to bear those costs. Now, what are some examples of social costs?
Liability insurance.
Well, no, not the insurance themselves, no. I don't think so.
I mean, you said like pollution?
Pollution, yeah. See, in other words, if a company produced something and bore all the costs of that production, which would include minimizing or eliminating pollution, then what would happen to their financial costs?
It'll skyrocket.
It'd be a lot higher, correct? So what businesses do is they say, well, we're going to pay for the production of this product, but we're not going to pay the full cost because we're going to pass as many of these costs on to society as possible. And so we get more pollution this way. We get unsafe working machines. You know, machines that are unsafe tend to be cheaper for the business than machines with a lot of safety devices on them. And we call so there's a natural tendency for businesses to pass as many costs as possible onto society, especially when you consider that we've got competition. I mentioned this before. If you show me a business with business person with a social conscience, I'll show you a business that'll go out of business, right? Because if you've got a social conscience and your costs increase as a result, then that puts you at a disadvantage when you're competing against other businesses that may not, don't bear these costs the way you're willing to. And so what is the only solution to this problem that we would naturally have in a free market system? Well, this is where government comes in, right? Government comes in and passes laws trying to minimize social costs. And what these laws do is that they say, well, left on your own, you are going to pass on as many costs as possible in your production process, but we're going to force you to bear at least a part of these costs yourself. Now, economically, this makes sense as long as all participants in this market are playing by the same rules. You know, as long as all the businesses are subject to the same laws, then their costs may increase, but at least they can compete on a level playing field. Okay, so what are examples of social costs, financial and otherwise, pollution? We mentioned unsafe working conditions, depletion of natural resources. Instead of when you cut down trees, it's cheaper just to let the land go barren than it is to, plant young trees to take the place of those you cut down, things like that.
You're not going to have more trees in the future.
Yeah.
I just read something in another class recently about a vaccine that cost $12 to the public, but $11.50 of it was liability costs. So they were passing that on to the public in their charge for the vaccine. So what is that called?
Well, that would be a social cost. I mean, and anything that the business, any cost that a business doesn't bear themselves.
So there are laws then that say you can't put all that on the public? Because it sounded like in the article that's what they were doing, was passing.
Oh, well, now I think what you're getting at here, and this is the problem in so many cases, is who is responsible for making these laws, and what are their priorities? It's possible to get people in authority that are just fanatics, and go to extremes, and that's a problem. And you also have a big problem of rent seeking. Do y'all remember what rent seeking is?
Lobbying.
Yeah, when people lobby, put money into Congress, and to influence legislation that benefits their business, that's called rent seeking. And so, once you have the government responsibility for making such laws that you're talking about, those laws are passed to favor certain businesses, because.
And certain individuals
yeah, even.
Pockets.
Yeah.
Put the money in deep pockets.
Yeah, deep pockets, yeah.
Deep pockets.
Yeah. Well, what is an externality? A cost or benefit that falls on third parties and is therefore ignored by the two parties to the market transaction. See, when a product is produced, well, you've got costs to the one who produces it, and then you've got a benefit to the one who buys it. But an externality is something that people other than the one who produces it and the one who benefits from it, the purchaser, the consumer, pays for. And that's very common. You know, in a free market system where you don't have proper laws, this is one of the weaknesses of a free market system, is these externalities of all kinds. And a negative externality is the undesirable byproduct. There are positive externalities and there are negative externalities. Now, there are not really too many examples of positive externalities, but there are lots of examples of negative externalities. You know, the undesirable byproduct of the industrial process. How does government deal with externalities? It employs taxes, subsidies, regulations to discourage negative externalities and to encourage positive externalities. You know, there's a big thing. There are some government officials in control of certain influential agencies that think that coal, for example, is bad, period. And there's a movement in this country to put the coal business out of business, period. And, might be an extreme position to take, but that kind of thing can happen when you got, you know, individuals or a group that gains control, and then they have certain, how to say, they got certain maybe extreme ideas. But yet, you know, once they got that power, well, they can do whatever they want. So this leads to conflict, and the conflict oftentimes is between states and the federal government, science versus politics, or social needs versus growth, and favoritism, which includes rent-seeking. Social needs versus growth is a big one. What is the source of all growth? Well, but before you have demand, what is necessary? Money perhaps. But how do you get money? Work? Yeah, you're getting closer. Yeah. See, how does society produce things that have value? Well, they work, right? Now, but what is the source to growth? But how does the society generate more jobs?
Demand.
Well, but how do we make sure that people are able to demand?
Free markets.
See, the source to growth, the source to growth is saving. See, the source of growth is we produce something that has value, and then instead of spending all that, we take a part of that and we save it. Now, savings in economics means money earned but not spent. That's a definition of savings. So any no matter what system, I mean, if you talk about a free market system, then the individuals work, and then they earn, and then they take a part of their earnings and save. Now, in a communist type system where you have a totalitarian government, how does it work?
The will of totalitarians.
Well, the government forces people to save. You see, if the definition of savings is money earned but not spent, what are taxes? Huh? If the definition of savings is money earned but not spent, then what are taxes?
Money spent but not earned?
Yeah, it's saving.
Okay.
that was a complete guess number.
Taxes is a form of saving. I mean, just because it may not be voluntary doesn't mean that it's not saving. In other words, in a communist type country, the government forces, first people work, and then the government forces them to save, and that could be through high taxes, you see, and then they take the money, the government takes the money, and they invest it in new plants and equipment. Now, in a free market system, see, the difference between the communist system and the free market system is that in a free market system, private individuals will use those savings. Now, traditionally, they will borrow those savings, or they save themselves, and then they use these savings to make investments in new plants and equipment and new technology and innovations. See, this is how any system, whether it be a totalitarian system or whether it be a free market system, growth is growth. Growth always comes from work, from bringing value into existence, not consuming all of that value, saving a portion of that value, and then using those collective savings to make investments in new plants and equipment, new technology, etc. And that's what grows any society. No matter what political system you've got, growth is growth. All right? Now, if you have a conflict between social needs versus growth, what that means is that we always have social problems, right? You've always got people who are unemployed. You've always got people that need assistance in terms of food and shelter. You've got people that are perhaps sick and they can't afford hospital, and so we help them. And I mean, it's all kinds of social needs. But the problem, but what can happen is that if society becomes tunnel vision in terms of those social costs, okay, they instead of people work, value is generated. Those people pay taxes, so that's a form of savings, and instead of spending those savings on growth, we spend those savings on social programs. Now, what's going to happen to growth if that becomes out of balance? In other words, if we don't spend enough money on investing in new technology and research and development and new plants and equipment, but we spend a disproportionately amount on social programs, then what happens to growth?
Growth stagnates.
And that's exactly what's happening in especially Europe, but it's happening here as well. Okay, to maybe a lesser extent, but it's a balancing act, and you need to spend money in social programs, but you also need to spend money on growth. So you need both. Too much in one extreme or too much in the other extreme is not good for society. See? But so in order, the best of all possibilities is sort of a compromise or a balance between these two extremes. But when one offsets the other to a large extent, then bad things start to happen. So what is the problem with lengthy and detailed laws? Complications and enforceability. The analogy I like to use, I read this once a long time ago in the Wall Street, but imagine if we've passed a law saying that no one could wear a tie. Now, would it be easy to enforce that law? Well, yeah. I mean, everyone knows what a tie is, right? And if you're caught out in public wearing a tie, well, then you're in violation of the law, right? Pretty simple. But let's say that we pass a law saying that people cannot wear a beautiful tie. Now, what's the problem?
You don't know what it is. So like,
who's to define what beautiful means? And then you get in all kinds of problems of enforcing that law. And that this is the problem with lengthy laws. Laws that are too lengthy and complicated lead to confusion, and they're very difficult to enforce.
Like the health care law.
The health care law is a very large and complex law. And therefore, it is a law that's very difficult to enforce because of its complexity.
It's like at least 1,000 pages long.
Well, the regulations that go along with the healthcare law runs for 22,000 pages.
Yeah.
22,000 pages. Now, it's interesting that Virginia has a provision that in the Commonwealth of Virginia. When the legislature passes or proposes a bill, that bill can only cover one topic, and that topic has to be in the title of the bill. Now, if bills only covered one topic, it would be therefore only ran for maybe a paragraph, then would it be easy for us to know what we're voting for? But if a bill covers thousands of pages, then is it easy to know what we're voting for?
You have to pass it to find out what.
Yeah, see, it's very difficult to know what you're voting for when bills become so complex and lengthy. all right. So what is the point of George Orwell's book Animal Farm? Power corrupts no matter how noble the intent. Centralized control to ensure equality leads to a privileged class and more inequality. Anyway, Animal Farm is a book that was, you know, it's one of those books that are just become very famous. And but that was the point to the book.
Years ago.
High school. Yeah, it's one of those books that, you know, that are usually required reading. And what is the progressive movement? Advocates wealth distribution to end conflict between the rich and the poor, limit big business, and segregate races. Anyway, there's a progressive, there was, has been what is called a progressive movement, and these, you know, this movement has been instrumental in making laws. Now, you know, whether those laws are good or bad, I'm not saying, but I mean, it is something you ought to be aware of. That you know, there are certain groups that that greatly influence legislation. Progressive movement being one of them. What would the progressive move? Progressive be Austrians or Keynesians? And they would tend to be Keynesians. And of course, you all know the difference by now, right? Between Keynes and Austrians. Keynes is, you know, if you can manage demand, you can manage the economy. And Austrians are more free market. Now, what is Social Security? Why is Social Security a Ponzi scheme? Well, first of all, what is a Ponzi scheme?
I think it's the investment scheme where you reward early investors with money from late investors.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. That's well put. It's
I read that from a cartoon by Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, by Bernie Madoff. That's the latest Ponzi scheme was by Bernie Madoff. But what Bernie Madoff did is that he convinced a lot of people that he was a good investor. And that he could make them very generous returns on any money they gave him, which he would then invest, or supposedly invest. And he said, you know, if you give me your money, I can make you a 20% return. So people, you know, he was very convincing, and people gave him money. And lo and behold, those people made 20% on their investments. And so they talked to their friends and said, man, this guy's a genius. And so their friends started, give Bernie Madoff money. And he promised them the same thing. And lo and behold, they made a 20% return. Well, his investing was so stellar that it almost defied reality. Of course, how was he able to give all these people a 20% return. Well, the only way that he could do it was from the money that was given to him from the latest investors. See, as long as he could convince more and more and more people to invest with him, then he would take much of their money and give to the early people generous returns. And that would encourage more people. And see, and as long, see, what a Ponzi scheme is that, everyone really benefits as long as more people enter into the system. But once you get a lack of people entering into the system, then there's not enough money to give these people their generous returns, and before too long the whole thing just falls apart. See, and there's been many Ponzi schemes throughout history. Well, that's exactly what Social Security is. Social Security is a giant Ponzi scheme. You see, there's a big difference between Social Security and insurance. If you have an insurance company, what money do insurance companies use to pay off on claims? Well, what a typical insurance company will do is that they'll take people's money and then they'll put it into the markets. They'll earn a return on their money. You know, this is the way endowments work. They'll make a return on their money, and then when people have a claim, they pay those people not out of the principal. The principal would be the amount of money that they started with, but they would make payment on claims from the return on that principal. Now, if the company never touches the principal, but is always only making claims on the return of that principal, then how sound is that? Well, that's a very sound business venture. See, it's going to be, sometime when people donate money to universities or colleges, we've got a lot of money donated to New River. What a lot of wealthy people will do is that they'll say, well, I'll give you, like $1 million if you promise to invest this money somewhere, and then you take the return that you make and you help people with their tuition, see, in scholarships. Well, that's a very sound business principle, you see, because as long as that capital is making a return, then these scholarships can last ad infinitum. But if a person donates X amount of money to let's say New River and says, well, you take this money and just pay people for scholarships, well, that may not last long. I mean, once the money is gone, it's gone. See, that's not a very sound business principle. Well, Social Security doesn't work this way. When we pay in Social Security on a Monday, by Tuesday, that money is given to someone else. You see, zero of it is invested in the markets. And where does Social Security get the money to pay people Social Security? Well, we got to get more people entering the system, or at least those people paying more and more into the system, so we can afford to pay people on the other end. See, that's exactly the way a Ponzi scheme works. The stability of Social Security is really no better than any other Ponzi scheme. The only difference is that government has the ability to what? To, with the help of the Federal Reserve, they've got the ability to create money, which is what they've been doing. They also have more control over people's taxes. If they need more money, well, they just raise people's taxes. That's something Bernie Madoff couldn't do. But it's still, the essence of the program is still, based on, a Ponzi scheme. How does this differ from private insurance? I just talked about this. Why are unemployment benefits a good idea economically as well as socially? Well, again, we know what we're talking about is the role of government. That's what this chapter is on government. And a role of government is to pay unemployment benefits. And, of course, there's a social reason that we want to help people that are in need. But what is the economic reason for paying unemployment benefits?
On the slide.
The economic reason is that we don't want the people who are unemployed to stop spending money. Because if we, this is what happened, during the early years of the 1930s. You know, unemployment got worse. People became unemployed. There was no unemployment benefits. You know, this came in the mid-30s under, the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt. And so those people simply stopped spending money. Demand went down. Excessive inventories built up, and more people were unemployed. So instead of that, if we pay people, then demand will be propped up, and that's going to prevent unemployment from getting as bad or as fast as it would otherwise. It may not prevent unemployment, period, entirely, but it'll slow the process down. Now, Medicare provides health insurance to people 65 years and older and some disabled people. And Medicare is the second or third largest outgo for the federal government. It's a huge amount of money. Yeah. And what is the difference between Part A and Part B? Part A is hospital insurance and Part B is medical insurance. So it's divided into these two, hospital and medical. And like in my case here at the school, I don't have to pay for Part A because that's handled through another insurance. Okay, what is Medicaid? Provides medical care for the poor. Now, what is the difference between Medicare and Medicaid? Now, this is something that a lot of people don't realize. That Medicare is insurance, but Medicaid is an equity loan.
Oh.
See, people who receive Medicare never have to pay that money back. But people who receive Medicaid have to pay that money back because it's a loan. Now, this has not been a problem before a new health care bill because most people that were who received Medicaid payments didn't have any property. So when they died, there was not much, if anything, to take away from them. But what the new health care bill did is that it increased the number of people who receive Medicaid, people of higher incomes. And those people, may own a house or they may own a car. So like if the government, pays a person $100,000 in Medicaid, when that person dies, then that $100,000 has to be taken from that person's property, instead of the children inheriting the house has to be sold to make the payment to the government for the Medicaid. See, Medicaid is an equity loan, but it's a big difference between Medicaid and Medicare in terms of the finances. And what is Obamacare? It requires citizens to have qualifying health coverage and expands Medicaid. See, that's the problem with the new health care law. It expands Medicaid. And a lot of people, receive the Medicaid but don't realize that it's not free money, but it's a loan that has to be paid back plus interest. People without coverage will pay a tax. And this is what we're experiencing now. And this is the first year where if you don't have insurance, then you have to pay a penalty. That penalty is relatively low, but it in 2, 3, 4 years, it increases quite a bit. I mean that, everyone has to have health insurance or pay a fine. Yeah. The family, the estate. It's taken from the estate.
So how do they get it from the estate if you never sell your property?
Oh, they force you to sell.
So you will pay it.
Yeah. Eventually. Yeah, the government is going to get their money, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what is an...
So in that situation, what happens with people who
well, then it's a loss. See, that's where it's been in the past. In the past, this hasn't been an issue because most people who received Medicaid were real low-income people, and they didn't have property to begin with. So you can't take blood from a stone, you know. So it kind of ended there. But what's happening now is that, you know, with the new health care law, more and more, you know, higher-income people are receiving Medicaid. And so in years to come, see, this is still is not a problem because it's such a new law, but in years to come, you know, when those people die, then the money will be taken from their estate. So instead of the, you know, the property being inherited by the children, it'll be, you know, taken by the state up to the amount that's owed.
So when they say government subsidized, that's the amount that you're
going to
pay back.
Yeah. In Medicaid, you know. Now, see, with Medicare, it's like insurance, where as soon as you start, as soon as you have a job, then you pay into Medicare. See, so people who receive Medicare never have to pay the money back because, well, you know, they've helped fund Medicare throughout their working years. But with Medicaid, you know, people don't pay into that, so it's kind of like, well, you know, people don't pay into it, but certain people receive from it, and so the government says, well, this is, you know, we can't just give money away like this, so we'll lend you money for the time being, but you know, but it is a loan. Now, what is an unfunded liability? Government commits itself to spending money on programs but does not provide adequate funding. And unfunded liabilities is a huge problem and going to be more of a problem because what an unfunded liability is that, you know, Congress likes to pass laws where they can get credit for helping people or, you know, certain groups. But they don't like to pay for those programs. So how can you help somebody, you know, pass a law that helps groups of people but not have to pay for it? Well, you simply require, like in the, if you're talking about the federal government, you require states to pay for it. You know, that's called an unfunded liability. A liability is something that's owed. So the federal government passes laws, that has a liability, but doesn't fund that liability, you know, through any tax provisions or anything, but simply makes, most of the time, it's states, you know, it says to states, well, you must provide this service, but we're not going to help pay for it. You're going to pay for it, but by law, you've got to do it. That's called an unfunded liability. And the problem with unfunded liabilities is that it's easy for Congress to pass laws like this because they can get credit for, you know, helping certain groups of people and yet not bear any of the costs.
Hey, I don't remember what. We just talked about something. For them, that's a social cost for them.
Yeah, it's a social cost, yeah. What is a flat tax? A proportional tax is a tax whereby everyone pays the same rate regardless of income. Like a flat tax or would be everyone pays 10% of their income, period, whether you're rich or poor. That's called a flat tax. A value-added tax is a tax on the purchase price of a good representing the value added along the supply chain. Value-added tax is popular in Europe, and every time value is added to something along the chain of events leading up to the finished product, then the person who pays for that collective tax along the chain is the people who purchase the good in the final stage. So it's kind of like a sales tax, but it's applied and collected differently than a sales tax would be. You know, a sales tax would apply only to the last stage of the process, whereas a value-added tax is a tax that affects everyone along the chain of events that leads to the finished product. Now, what is a progressive income tax? A graduated income tax is a tax whereby taxpayers pay in accordance to their tax bracket after exemptions and deductions. Now, the way our system works is, the more you earn, you can put in the higher tax brackets, and therefore the higher percentage of your income in that money that falls in that tax bracket you pay. This is something that's easily misunderstood, but let me give you an example. Let's say that a break-off between, now I'm taking these figures, I'm just making this up out of my head, but let's say up to $20,000 income, you pay 10% in income tax. And over $20,000, let's say between $20,000 and $30,000, you pay 15%. So, now, if your income is, let's say, $25,000, how do we calculate how much taxes you owe? In other words, if the break-off is at $20,000 income between a lower tax bracket and a higher tax bracket, and you're okay, I wish you well in that. Let me know what happens. Yeah, he's got a job interview, so hope he gets it. But anyway, let's say your income is $25,000. That puts you in 25%. What did I say? Again, I'm taking this out of my head. 25% tax bracket. Do you pay 25% on $25,000? No. Well, no, you don't, period. See, we have what's called a marginal tax system. Margin means the last unit. Every dollar in our tax system, our income tax system, is based on what bracket that single dollar falls in. So in other words, if the tax bracket is 10% up to $20,000, then a very wealthy person that has a high income will still only pay 10% on the first $20,000. And then if the next tax bracket is, let's say 25%, then dollars above that $20,000, those individual dollars that fall in that tax bracket will pay the higher tax. See what I mean? And that's how it goes up the tax bracket. So we have a graduated. Well, graduated means that there's a little difference here. Graduated means that the higher income, the large percentage of that income you pay in taxes, but the tax is graduated in that, or it's a marginal tax system in that each dollar is taxed according to what bracket that dollar falls in. Okay? Now, there are exemptions and deductions. An exemption is how many people in your family. If you're single, then you've got one exemption. Let's say an exemption is worth $1,000. Well, if you file as a single, then you subtract $1,000 from how much taxes you would otherwise owe. Now, if you're married and you file jointly, then you have two exemptions. So you take away $2,000 from any taxes you would otherwise own. Now, let's say you're married and you've got three children, and each member of the family is an exemption. So if it's $1,000, that's $5,000, right? So however amount of money you would otherwise owe, you take away $5,000. See, so everyone who files income tax has at least one exemption. Family of two exemptions. Family of 10, they would have 10 exemptions, which would be $10,000, if each exemption was worth $1,000. That's how exemptions work. Now, deductions go above exemptions, and deductions are expenses that you can take away from your tax bill. Like in America, If you have if you're buying on a mortgage, a house on a mortgage, then any interest you owe is a tax deduction. So if you would otherwise owe, let's say, $5,000 in taxes, but you paid $1,000 in interest on your mortgage, then you pay $1,000 less. See, that's a takeaway. If you give money to charity or give money to your church, that's a deduction. If you give $1,000 to charity and can prove it, then that's a deduction. You take that away from how much money you would otherwise owe in taxes, which is a little bit unfair because let's say you've got two people and one person is paying $1,000 a month in rent and another person is paying $1,000 a month on a mortgage. Now, who benefits? Are these the same? Yeah, the guy that's paying the mortgage is better off because the guy that's renting has no deduction. But the guy who's on paying on a mortgage is going to pay less in taxes.
And then the guy
even though their incomes may be the same.
Then the guy that's renting will still, even though it's not his property, still has to pay, also has to pay property taxes on it.
Well, the property tax normally comes out of rent, you know, indirectly. Landlords, have expenses, and that's all included in rents. But the point is, this is why, like in Canada, interest paid on a mortgage is not a tax deduction, because Canada feels that it's unfair. It gives the wealthy more privilege than the not so wealthy, because who can afford to buy a house? The not so wealthy or the people with more income. Usually, in a sound society anyway, economy, people's with a higher income. So if you have interest payments as a deduction, you're helping higher income people and not low income people. A marginal tax, I just explained to you, percentage of each additional dollar of income that goes to taxes. How does our federal income tax work? And I just explained this: exemptions, deductions, standard deduction. Now, everyone gets a standard deduction, by the way. I didn't mention that. You can itemize your deductions, but if you don't have enough deductions to add up to the standard, to a certain amount of money, then you can claim the standard deduction, which everyone qualifies for. See? So if you have a big mortgage and you give money away to your church and other charities, well, maybe the standard deduction is $5,000, but you've got $8,000 of deduction. So you itemize and you claim the higher deduction. But if you don't have a mortgage and you don't give money away to charity, then you could maybe just claim the standard deduction. And which would be a short form, by the way. There's a short form for people who just say, "Well, my situation is very simple. I don't have a bunch of deductions, so I just claim the standard deduction. This is my income. This is standard deduction. These are my exemptions, and this is my tax." See, well, that just takes a short form. But if you have a lot of expenses that can be counted as a takeaway from your taxes, then you file the long form where you have to itemize everything. Now, most people file short form and simply declare the standard deduction along with whatever exemptions they qualify for. Well, this link, by the way, will take you to the debt clock. I did go to this earlier today, and if you've never been there, maybe I'll go to it real quick. Yeah, maybe not, but here we go.
Let's see how many times you opened it.
Yeah. The national debt is over 18 trillion.
At 18 trillion
this semester. I was looking at this earlier, that the debt per taxpayer is $154,000. And now it's interesting that the personal debt, I was just looking at this earlier, there's personal debt here. Total debt per, let's see, total debt, student loan. Well, look at the student loan debt. That's bigger than credit card debt. Look at that. Here's a student loan debt over $1 million. Total credit card debt is less than a trillion. Where student loan debt is over $1 trillion.
Credit card debt's going down, while student debt's going up.
Oh, is it?
Oh, and then you can look at the state debt.
Credit card debt is going down? Oh, is it really? I didn't notice that. Oh, that's interesting. Huh. But student loan debt is going up.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Then you can look at state debt box.
Anyway, you know, this is something that is interesting to look at, but I'm not going to belabor that. This is something you can do. Let's see now. Why am I getting two of these? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Okay. What is... I got to rush through this. We've only got 10 minutes, so I want to rush through this. What is the purpose of our present federal income tax system?
Politics.
Now, here's the point. Here's the point. Almost all economists agree that we could raise more revenue on a lower tax rate if we had a flat rate tax. You know, you can have a flat rate tax. You could maybe have certain exemptions, maybe certain deductions, but you could simplify the whole process and essentially have a flat rate tax. In other words, that's much more efficient and simpler and would be better for almost everybody. So why do we have this complicated tax system we do? And the answer is politics.
Rent-seeking.
Rent-seeking is a big part of it, exactly right. Because you see, with the system we have, see, our basic tax system is very simple, but what's complicated are all the exceptions to the basic rules. And those exceptions, by and large, have been carved out in order to help one special interest group or another. I mean, with rent-seeking, well, rent-seeking would not be what it is today if we didn't have a progressive income tax the way we do. See, because one of the ways that politicians can reward certain groups is to modify the tax system that will benefit some people and hurt others. So our present tax system is used as a tool by politicians to gain favor. But that's the only reason we've got the tax system we do, because it's very it's not very efficient. It's very complicated, it'll persist as long as we have politicians, I think.
Yeah, we're talking about long, complicated laws.
Yeah.
Income tax first came with the 16th Amendment in 1913. Of course, you probably knew that.
Yeah, and at the beginning, the income tax was very in 1913. Two major events happened in 1913. The Federal Reserve was brought into existence, and income tax was passed into law. Well, I'm going to skip this. This is just a tax that parallel. If your income is above a certain amount, then you are subject to what's called an alternative minimum tax, which is really maximizing your taxes. and a lot of deductions and exemptions are eliminated from this, like the parallel tax system. It's called the alternative minimum tax. Tax incidence, the distribution of tax burden among taxpayers. What is the ability to pay principle of taxation? Those with a greater ability to pay should pay more tax. So our graduate income tax, in theory, is just that. You know, the more you're able to pay, then the higher tax brackets you're in, and the large percentage of the money that falls in those tax brackets are paid in taxes. What is the benefits received principle? This would be like the tax on gasoline. You know, every gallon of gasoline that you buy, you pay a tax which goes to build and maintain roads. So those who drive the most or those who benefit the most pay the most taxes. A regressive tax is a tax percentage of income decreases as income increases. For example, a food tax is a regressive tax. If a poor person and a wealthy person both eat the same amount, now the wealthy person may eat more steak, you know, higher quality food, but if the poor person and a wealthy person eat the same amount and you have a tax on food, who bears the greatest burden, the rich or the poor?
The rich?
No, the poor bears the greatest burden. See, if a rich person and a poor person eat the same amount, then when the poor person buys food, a big portion of their income may go to pay that tax. Where when a wealthy person buys the same amount of food and therefore pays the same taxes, they're only paying a very small amount relative to their income. So a food tax hits the poor much harder than it hits the wealthy. And therefore, a food tax is a regressive tax. That's why some states, like Michigan, have eliminated taxes on food. If you go shopping in Michigan at Kroger's and your bill is $100, then it's $100. There's no taxes on that. Because Michigan has eliminated sales tax is by and large a state thing, and so several states have eliminated taxes on food and other consumer products because they're regressive taxes, and instead they'll raise taxes more where taxes are progressive rather than regressive. A monopoly, sole producer, and one of the functions of government is to prevent monopolies where a business can control a market and therefore without enough competition they can raise prices and take advantage of the consumer. So we have what are called antitrust laws, laws that are against monopolization and try to encourage more competition. How does government promote competition? Antitrust laws try to promote competition, okay? And collusion. Collusion is when two firms come together and they agree on what price to charge to the detriment of the consumer. So there are laws against collusion. Well, a natural monopoly, I've kind of run out of time here. I don't have time to get into that. Can a natural monopoly, now, here, I'm almost to the end here. How does the government promote full employment, price stability, and growth? By using monetary and fiscal policies. Now, what the next chapter is on fiscal policies. We have a chapter coming up on fiscal policies, and we have a chapter coming up on monetary policies. See, so what we did in this chapter is we talked about the general role of government, where now in the next two chapters we're going to get into fiscal policies, which are policies of the federal government primarily, and influencing the economy, and monetary policies are policies of the Federal Reserve. So that's what's coming up in the next two chapters, okay? But anyway, this completes chapter 6 on government, so what are y'all going to do for next time? Read chapter 7, right? Yeah. So anyway, I'll see you all next time.
Yeah. Something, so I just, a while ago on the internet, so I decided to find it again. Tax code in 1913 was about 400 pages.
400?